Okay, I think we're ready here for lesson four and of our study on Proverbs. And if you don't have a print version of the Bible, you might find it helpful. I put a few copies up here. Some of what we're going to look at is maybe just a little bit more helpful. I couldn't format it and fit the large selection of text in the slide. The text is there, but not formatted very well. So, as I mentioned by way of review here, in the opening of Proverbs, we've got the introduction, and we have the preface and the purpose, and then we have the great hinge for the work of the whole book. That's verse 7, where we're taught that the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge, but then the fools despise wisdom and instruction. So today we're going to start what I'm calling the My Son, Wisdom and Folly Discourses. And these are longer proverbs written by Solomon that move through the first 9 chapters. And in chapter 10, there's a distinct change in the way the proverbs have been written. And we'll look at those differences. But these are called discourse proverbs. Not all of them start with the phrase, my son. And then we have this person named Wisdom, and the person largely named Folly speaking. And we'll see what they have to say, and we'll take larger sections as we move through the book. So this morning, I want to start with verse 8 and verse 9. My son, hear the instruction of your father and do not forsake the law of your mother, for they will be a graceful ornament on your head and chains about your neck. So, what I'd like to cover today is all the rest of, from verse 8 through verse 33, I believe it is, all of chapter 1. And there's some questions about the organization and the layout of Proverbs that are not easy to answer. And so, if you have a print version, print versions even on the same version of the translation, different printings will look different. And that can be a little problematic when you're working through Proverbs. And the problem it presents is you're not sure how to organize it. What is linked to the next passage? What stands in distinction from something else? So when you look at Proverbs 1 in your Bible, do you see a break after line 9 and before line 10? In some passages you'll see it, and in some passages you won't in the New King James. Most of the ESV that I was able to look at had a line break, or did not have a line break. So when you look at verses 9 and 10, is there an extra line there? Is there a gap between 9 and 10? Or is it together?
Together. Together in the ESV.
Together in the ESV.
Yes, together.
What's that?
It is.
Several of the New King James that I saw had a gap, but our Pew Bible does not have one. So, who does show a gap? Anybody have one with a gap?
Spanish Bible does.
The Spanish Bible has a gap?
I think it's based off the NIV, though.
Okay. And you have a New King James with a gap, yeah. And what do you have back there?
King James doesn't have a gap.
King James does not have a gap.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
The ESV doesn't.
The ESV does not?
NASB.
NASB. Okay. Liz?
There's a little mark here that says new paragraph.
Yeah, okay. So they would have a new line there. So why is this even important? Why are we discussing it? Well, the problem is Proverbs is not like a story. Even these discourse Proverbs that are longer are not laid out like a historical narrative or a letter or even a genealogy. It's hard to know when one proverb starts and when one proverb stops. That's especially true in after chapter 10, because there appears to be no order to the proverbs, or largely no order, and so you're looking at at one couplet to another couplet and thinking, are they related or are they different? If it's a four-line proverb, quad stitch, I guess you'd call that, is that different? Is that two distich proverbs together, or is it one? And so there's a... I guess the point I'm trying to make by this is it's entirely up to you to decide whether these things are joined together or not, because it doesn't appear to me that it's clearly laid out in the text. But it also presents sort of a new rule for us, and that is printing is translating. The simple fact of committing Proverbs to paper involves a certain amount of translation, regardless of what you think the words themselves mean. So I think everybody here, we looked at the difficulty last week of taking these eight Hebrew words, and Hebrew is an inflected language, so the stems of the words and the endings dictate how compounded that word might be, right? So Latin and Greek are both well-known examples of inflected languages. The endings tell you much about the language, right? English is largely an uninflected language. Our inflections tend to be plural, right? We can tell the number sometimes by how the word ends. Other than that, English is largely uninflected. So you would expect Proverbs to expand some, right? Because eight words here have... those are compounded words. But so that's easy to understand. But what's not maybe as clear is that simply committing them to paper. Liz mentioned that her Bible has a paragraph mark between 9 and 10. Well, is it a new paragraph or not? You can't write Proverbs without some translative philosophy in place. Does that make sense? So if I tell you that I think this is connected to that, that's probably just my judgment. It may not be the judgment of the historical reading of the text by commentators and such. But the truth is, you'll probably find a lot of division if they address the fact at all. I haven't seen a lot of work done to simply give us the layout of Proverbs in a fashion that most people would be familiar with or would read through. Much of it's technical. I don't understand it. And it's difficult to follow. So I'm going to present a case on a certain unified path for what are often portrayed as three distinct sections in Proverbs, and may be portrayed that way simply because the way it was printed. And I'm going to make a case, and it's up for you to decide what is happening. Does that make sense? So if you look at it and you think, well, he grouped that together, I'm not sure I would have. Well, that's fine. Then when you teach class next time, you can divide them and make your case, and we'll know what it's all about here. So enough with the translation side, but I think it's important for you to remember that as we move through the entire book. So one of the other points I made is that in especially in these discourse passages, you find that in this condensed style of Hebrew writing, what was the sort of overarching characteristic of the rhyme in Hebrew poetry? Now, I'm assuming you guys know it's not the sound of the words, which is a little more characteristic of English poetry. What is it that rhymes in Hebrew poetry? What are we looking for? Liz?
Ideas?
Yeah. So something that's said and that thought is repeated or developed or built upon is the rhyming scheme that the Hebrews use. Perhaps there's some equivalent of iambic pentameter in Hebrew writing, but that's not the point. The point is the rhyming of ideas. And when you see things that are repeated, if you see that repetition, you can think rhyme in that sense, then you know this is important. They're trying to say something with emphasis. That's the way to read it. So let's look at 8 and 9 here for a minute. We'll start with verse 8, My son, hear the instruction of your father, and do not forsake the law of your mother. What parallels, what rhyming scheme, what repetition scheme do we find in verse 8? What things appear to be rhyming or repeated? Who's got some ideas?
Parental guidance.
Parental. What do you mean by that?
Mother and father.
Mother and father, okay, right. Sam, what were you saying?
Just parental instruction.
Parental instruction, okay.
Not to forsake it.
Not quite there, no. I don't buy that. I don't think that's precise enough, and I think here we can be a little more precise. Right? Father and mother, yes, I agree.
You've got the positive exhortation, and then the negative exhortation. So, hear it, don't forget it.
That's right. So, you have a complementary view of the verbs here, right? I want you to hear this and not forsake. So, that's right. There's a parallel as well. I think there are two more.
Instruction and law.
Instruction and law. That's right. Yeah. Instruction being a corrective course of action, law, Torah. That's the word they use. What else?
You got me on this one.
I think it's implied in the B section of verse 8, but it's there. In English, we supply it. It's not explicitly stated. Who's being spoken to? My son. So, my son, hear instruction, father. My son, do not forsake law of mother. So it's nearly a perfect parallel, right? I mean, we see each element given again. And one of the things I find comforting about verse 8 is the tender way Proverbs opens. So we just learned that it's the fool that despises wisdom and instruction, right? We learn of this dangerous character, the fool. But yet when the actual instruction begins, it's my son. It's not cold. It's not a distant teacher-pupil relationship, right? This is parental involvement. My son, do not forsake the teaching here, the instruction of your father. So, right away we can see that there's much contained within Proverbs in this opening verse. So, who are the primary educators of people in the covenant, who were the only ones who would be reading this, right? Folks who were part of the community of those in Solomon's day, the men who had been circumcised and children born to Jewish parents. So who is the primary giver of instruction? The parents, that's right, mom and dad. Mom and dad are the ones. And we also find that largely speaking, the content is given as well, right? So when we look at my son, hear these things and do not forsake these things, that's a very Hebrew way of thinking. The idea of accumulating knowledge without acting upon it. The idea of learning something but not using it in this setting would have been absurd. The Hebrews would never have looked at it that way. So there's a complementary way of approaching this. My son, I want you to hear this. And my son, I do not want you to forsake what's been taught. I don't want you to turn away from it. You need to embrace this in your life. We have instruction and we have law. Now, many people here have had some exposure to homeschooling, and one of the difficulties for many folks when they start educating their children, and if it's not restricted to just them, but schools face it and other institutions face it, and that's selecting or designing a curriculum, right? Some body of work that you're going to use to fill these young minds full of mush to help them organize their thoughts. And as parents who have gone through the process of selecting, sometimes you get it and think, well, that didn't turn out to be very helpful, and you do something else. And You know, you can spend a lot of time looking for the right material to simply present to your kids. And here Solomon focuses our attention that the core curriculum that we're using is God's Word. That's where we're starting. But in a sense, I don't think it ends there. It's the revealed Word of God and the experience that comes with the revealed Word of God. So Solomon is also saying that I'm going to give you some course correction. That's this idea of instruction. I want you to understand that this is the right way and this is the wrong way. I'm going to reorient your course. You're moving off axis here. And the idea that I'm going to impart to you the experience of what I've learned, the wisdom of what I've learned, that based from God's law. One of the commentators, Charles Bridges, makes this statement that I found helpful, in that children are rational creatures, and it's instruction, not blind submission, that must be inculcated. Yet they are wayward. Instruction must therefore be enforced with the authority of law. God puts his own stamp upon parental discipline. So, not only are parents told this is what they need to do, right? God's putting his stamp of approval that parents, not only is this a good option, this is precisely your responsibility. You need to be instructing your children now how they should live their life. Abandon the notion that they know what to do. They're wayward children. Their hearts are not in the right condition. You need to watch over them and instruct them carefully each and every step of the way. So, looking at verse 9, what do we see in terms of parallels there? What parallels, what repetition, what Hebrew rhyming scheme is in verse 9? Ornament and chains, yeah, that's right. Yeah. What else? That's one.
The instruction in the law. It repeated again.
Yeah, the they. For they, that this instruction, this wisdom, that's right. What else? What's the last one? Body parts? Mm-hmm. The head and the neck. So I find this interesting. And this is one of the reasons why I'm going to argue that verses 8 and 9 are connected with 10 through 19. And it seems to me that Solomon is helping the parents understand their responsibility. That's what verse 8 does. But verse 8 also communicates to the student that God's given the responsibility to my parents. And this is what he's told them to do. But then in verse 9, why would you write what the effect of this learning will be upon your life? Why would you want to describe what this learning will look like in picturesque language? What's the point? Why would you tell someone, you do what I've told you to do, and it will be like you have a graceful ornament, a crown on your head. It'll be chains, be necklaces. Why would you tell somebody that? What do you hope that does to them?
Encourages them to love the truth.
What's that?
Causes them to love the truth.
Love the truth? What were you going to say there?
It's an encouragement. We're sinful creatures. Listen to me. Don't do that. But if you think about the reward,
yeah,
that's why.
Yeah. Liz?
Build on something you said earlier, is that, you know, children, when looking into the world, they're sinful, fallen creatures, and they're wayward naturally, and their idea of what this law and instruction is going to be for them is naturally going to be, this is not going to be something I'm really going to be associated with. This is not what my peers are associated with.
Yeah, this, and just to follow up to the parents, have you guys ever had an experience where one or more of your children were not excited about learning the instruction in the law? Martha.
Then there is no need, right? You think, like, maybe whatever is being told, I just have to accept it. But what's the importance of this? So I believe that verse 9 is emphasizing the importance of verse 8. The saying that if you do this, this is the benefit.
That's right. Yeah, there are benefits, and you want your kid to see the benefits, right? You want them to imagine the benefits. They've got to be able to see the value of what you're giving them. That's really what an inducement is, or an enticement, isn't it? And Solomon, remember, is using picturesque language to help cement that idea into the young child's head. Now, I think today it might be kind of an odd way of wording it, wouldn't it? If you memorize the Ten Commandments, just for a moment, I want you to think of one of my sons, perhaps the older one, and me sitting down with him and say, you memorize the Ten Commandments, it'll be like you're wearing a lot of necklaces. Now, if he had just watched an episode of the A-Team, then he might say, yeah, that's cool, I'll do that, right? Outside of that, I suspect he's probably not interested. I suspect, right? Oh, I didn't see you right there, William. Sorry about that. So there's a sense, though, in which doesn't jewelry, and I'm including the crown that's implied here, doesn't jewelry also communicate to us the idea of ownership? It expresses some identity. It expresses who we are. That we might wear a the crown says you're the king. It says here's who you are. The Lord Chancellor of England has a medallion that he wears to denote his office. People might have a necklace or something they wear that communicates their affiliation with someone else. I think today tattoos are in part a response to this. I think people want to denote who they are owned by or what their identity is through tattoos. But you get the idea that Solomon says this will be your identity. This will be something that's attracted to you. You're going to be known as this type of person if you do what I tell you to do, if you learn from me and you obey. So I think there's a sense in which, however precisely we want to look at the inducement, I think that idea of the inducement or the reward is important because of what takes place next. So in verses 10 through 19, I'm going to read this and then run through some observations here. He starts again, my son. It's this phrase that we see repeated, but here we see it without it, I don't think, starting a new major section. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path. For their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. But they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners. So, think about this. I find, as I work through Proverbs, especially these discourse Proverbs, one of the things to be helpful in my mind is to identify the verbs. Is to look to see what verbs are used, whether they're implied or whether they're explicitly stated, and that sets the tone of what's being communicated here. So let's look for just a second in verse 10. What verbs do you find, and who is speaking? So who's saying something? Who's doing something? What are they doing? What do we see in verse 10?
Sinners are trying to entice, and then the person being spoken to is told not to consent.
That's right. So you've got both the they and the you. The father is speaking in this fashion. They are going to entice you. It'd be an enticement. Do not consent. And then 11, they are going to say, they're going to say, come and lie and lurk and swallow and go. And we shall find and we shall fill, cast and let. So you can hear the story being filled out with just those verbs. These guys are very active in what they're doing, right? They're presenting many different thoughts to him. And the father's response, do not walk. Keep. And keep, I think, points back to verse 8, line B. Do not forsake the law of your mother. That's, so he's repeating the instruction in verse 10. Do not consent and do not walk. And then he's reminding him, keep what we have entrusted to you. And then in verse 16, he's describing what is happening to them, right? They run, they're making haste, they're looking to shed blood. This is who they are. And then in 17, he's relating the consequence of all this. If you join with them, right, then there's a net that's spread for you. That's picturesque, isn't it? You're walking into a trap. They are lying, they are lurking, they're greedy, and their lives are taken away. So it's an interesting way to approach it, is to just focus on the verbs to see where the action's taking place. And then you see, I think it's helpful to then identify the enticements or the inducements for why this conversation is taking place. So what are the inducements for the young man to associate with the wicked? What are his inducements?
Precious possessions and spoils.
That's it, but I think that's jumping a bit. I think there's something that comes before that.
Maybe fellowship with the evildoers?
Yeah, that's right. Where do you see that?
Yeah, just kind of the lurking and sharing of the goods with
them. Yeah, come with us. The us, just come with us. That's how the enticement starts, doesn't it? The enticement doesn't start with, I feel like cold-blooded murder. The enticement says, come on, come with us. Now remember, this is not an exact conversation that someone had with his son. Solomon's paraphrasing. The enticement doesn't come on full steam. It takes time to develop, right? So nobody wakes up and says, a guy knocking at the door, and he says, you know, I'm looking for a killing spree. Are you in? What? No, at first there's, you need to come with us. And then don't worry, because all we're going to do is lie. Right? That's all we're going to do, is just lie still. Later on, we're going to lurk. You see the progression taking place here? We're going to start lurking. And who are we going to lurk for? Well, those who are innocent, right? Those who don't deserve to have any of this. So there's lying in wait, hoping to do something. That's rather passive. Come with us and lie, right? That's not really active, right? That's how it builds. And then lurk, so a little more active, but not, it's not an assault yet, is it? It's lurking. We're sensing opportunities. And what Solomon wants, and this is why, when he says in verse 6, so that you can understand the proverb and the enigma, the riddle, the sayings of the wise. And it's because not everything that comes at you is visible at first glance, including the words of instruction. It took me a little while to see the unfolding nature of this enticement that was coming to the young man. And this is how you give yourself to Proverbs, by looking and pondering these words over and over again until you start to see what the message is, how it's unfolding. And I think one of the ideas is the nature of the building of trouble that comes to this young man, and how he doesn't see it, right? Because at first it starts with something polite, like, come with us. And then in the end, it's finally, we swallow them, right? I mean, we give them over to the earth to be swallowed. And we what? We fill our houses. With what? Precious possessions. Not with junk, but with stuff we can really use. So what sorts of things would appeal to somebody who's falling prey to this? Obviously some have, right? Come with us, it's plural, right? Come with us, there's a group. Where would they... What is it that's going to appeal to someone? We mentioned fellowship, right? A sense of belonging. What else?
Identity.
Identity, that's right. You'll be one of us. Yeah, and I think that idea of being one of us is contained in this, let's cast in your lot among us, let us have all have one purse. It's one group. When you're with us, you're a full partner on day one, right? You come in with us and you're numbered among us. You have the right to be one of us, your share. What else? So a sense of belonging, a fellowship, of identity. What else is an inducement provided here?
Power, control.
Power, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Where do you see power?
Well, I think just the fact that they can do things to these people, that they, you know, these people are sort of at their mercy, that, you know, that they can do things to them, that they can... You know, that they're sort of the bullies of the block.
So, yeah. That's a good point. What else?
Martha? I think there's a reward too, because in the painting, it seems that at the end of it all, you're going to get some precious possessions. So if you join this group, I mean, there's something coming up in the world.
Right. Yeah. We don't have to be too lofty. I think we can carnally look at this and say they want stuff, right? They're not happy with what they've got, and this is a way to get more. Yeah. So this is a pattern that the father and mother want the child to avoid. Right? I think that's the whole idea. We're here to teach you. This is our mandate. And we're going to provide you with something that's beautiful, with a crown and with chains about your neck. But my son, if sinners entice you from what? From the riches I'm promising to another form of riches. So here we find in verse 10, well, in verse 8, he opened, my son, I want you to listen to me. I want to talk to you. And you find in verse 10, my son, if sinners entice you, and he describes the graphic nature of what's happening. And then in verse 15, you know, notice in verse 14, he sort of ends the story ambiguously, doesn't he? He says, cast in your lot among us, let us all have one purse. That's not the end of a story, is it? That's a cliffhanger. But it's another transition in verse 15. It's now my son. So it's no longer the voice of the wicked who are plotting innocent blood, but the voice is now back to the father, my son, and the mother. My son, don't walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from this evil path. So there's a reflection on that parental relationship, on building a bond with your children to be able to communicate to them. I think this is what Solomon has in mind when he gets to verse 15 again. And then part of the problem here is that the kid, he may sense that there are commandments to be violated, but he doesn't see that they're going to send these people to their death when the enticement comes by the words, come with us, right? So when you're hearing come with us, you're not putting into place all the commandments you're about to break and the laws you're about to break. That he doesn't see it. And why? Because he hasn't heard the rest of the story, has he? Because they've only approached him with saying, be one of us, come hang out, right? And so the father is applying wisdom that he's learned over the years and trying to impart that to the son to say, this is a trap and you can't see it. That's why the language of verse 17, surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. Right? Now you think about that. Who would put a net down in front of a bird hoping to catch it? Well, I mean, nobody would. The birds are just not going to pay attention to it, right? But the Father is trying to point to the Son that when you're listening to these people, you're looking at the bait and not the net. That's the difference, isn't it? The Father is trying to teach the child, you need to look for the net when you encounter these people. And how do you do that? How do you, when someone says, come with us, how do you find the net? So wisdom is what allows you to see through these words, to see who the character of these people are, what are their exploits like, what have they accomplished in life, how are they known, right? These are the sorts of questions the Father's going to ask. What's the Son going to ask? Does it sound like fun? Right? Isn't that, you know, these guys look like they're having a good time. I'd like to go hang out with them. And Dad, Mom are thinking, well, who are these jokers? What have they done with their life? What are their parents like? What are they doing? You see, the Father is connecting the dots. That was a phrase that was given a few weeks ago to understand in the preface. The point of this building of godly wisdom is so that you can begin to connect the dots. And that's precisely what the dad is doing here. He's saying, let me tell you what these guys are going to do. They're going to say, come with us. And then they're going to soften it. Well, let's lie in around for just a little bit and see. Then let's lurk. And then the real destruction comes. So the Father's connected the dots, and he wants his Son to learn how to connect the dots. And he's saying, Son, you've got to learn to look for the net and not to look at the bait. So George Lawson, another commentator, writes, when transgressions varnish over their crimes, it's our part to pluck the false covering and to represent sin to ourselves and to our children in its true colors and in its tendency to other iniquities of higher aggravation. I like the idea of trying to pluck apart the story to see what the true colors are like. This is going to be a problem, and I want you to see it in its true light, not as it's varnished, not as it's covered. So in verse 15, we have a very clear remedy. Do not head down this path. I think Paul has something similar in mind when he exhorts Timothy to flee youthful lusts. Do not walk down that path. When you see that woman, flee. You move the other direction. Get on a different road. Walk around the other way. You flee that temptation. I can hear the Father saying, I know how this story ends. I can connect the dots. And I can tell you, you're going to head down the wrong path. And I can also sense how difficult it is to communicate this to somebody who can't see it. Right? They can't see it. You see it. You've got this perch that's up here a little bit, that's got years of experience. You know these types. I don't need to know who they are. I know what type of persons they are. And you're not able to see the unraveling of what's about to take place. You've got to learn to look for the net and not the bait. But what's even harder is you've got to learn how to teach your children to look for the net and not the bait. Now that seems like an awfully, awfully tall order in my mind. It's really hard to figure it out yourself. But you got to figure it out in such a way that you can communicate it to your kids. John Trapp summarizes this idea in verse 17 and such with the trap. He said, silly birds pick up the meat, but see not the net, and so become prey to the fowler. If the fruits of the flesh grow out of the trees of your... I missed something here. God, grow out of the trees of, what did he say? I don't remember. Surely the devil is at inn with you. Meaning the inn. He's staying in the same place. You're lodging with the devil. That's the idea. You're eating with the devil and spending time with him. You are his birds, whom when he has well fed, he will broach you and eat you. He'll chew you and champ you, world without end, for eternal woe and misery. You see, this is the end in mind. This is not just a bad idea because it involves a criminal enterprise. This gets back to the idea that the fool partakes in these things. And who is the fool? He's the one that despises this instruction. We learn that fool also has, in its idea, an inclination of someone who wants to walk in an evil or iniquitous way. I think there's a lot here for us to see how the fool develops. He doesn't start off the fool, right? There are gradations. Well, if we had time in the next section, we'll see the gradations of this foolishness. But the point Trapp is making is that you're going to end up eating with the devil. And when he's done feasting on the innocent that you've plowed into the ground, he's going to feast on you. And you're going to spend eternity with him. That's what the Father sees. It's not just a criminal enterprise. It's not that it simply breaks one of God's commandments. You are on the path to perdition. Do not walk in their ways. The exhortation to live in the fear of God is, I think, demonstrated even in this first discourse. The wicked, they set a trap for themselves because they can't see what's going on. They are the ones who fall into this trap, right? I mean, that's what their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed blood, surely in vain in that set in the sight of any bird. But they lie in wait for what? They were lying in wait for innocent blood before, right? That's what they were looking for. They were lurking for it. They lurk secretly for their own lives. Well, how is that possible? Because earlier, what were they waiting for? They were waiting for the innocent who, without cause, are about to be killed, right? But that's not what happens. I mean, those innocent may have been killed. But what does the Father do? He twists the whole thing back around, doesn't he? He twists it around and said, you don't get it. They're lying in wait for whose blood? They thought it was just the innocent. But they're lying in wait for their blood. They are lurking for their own lives. And why? It's because they don't see the God who sees all things. They don't see that there is a God who rules over the affairs of men. And in the end, they consume themselves. They want to walk in that path, which is antithetical to following in the fear of God. The fear of God would say, I'm not going to walk in this iniquitous way. The fear of God says, God sees over all things. How can I do these things and not be exposed to God? That's what the man who walks in the fear of God is saying. I may not know all the details, but I know this is going to end up rather poorly. Because God sees all. But the wicked, he has no regard for what God sees, right? All they're looking for, those precious possessions, for the power, the fellowship, the identity, the things that we mentioned as the inducements. That's what they're looking for. But they've stepped in their own trap. They've stepped in their own trap. Without the knowledge of an all-seeing God to look at their lives, men believe they can escape all manner of responsibility. But they won't. Now, the question comes, who are you going to believe? Right? Are you going to believe what God's word and his law and my observations tell me? Are you going to believe that, come, hang out with us? It's a beautiful, beautiful tension, isn't it? That Solomon is developing to show the contrast of wisdom and folly. Right here at the opening, he wastes no time in just these, what, 10 verses. He's describing, I think, a beautiful picture of what the fool looks like. He's the one that walks after these guys, who falls prey to the inducement and doesn't consider the chains and the crown. Well, I had actually hoped to get all the way through 33, and that didn't work. So, sorry about that. But we'll take time for questions or observations.
So in verse 17, it says, surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. So what it's saying is, if you spread the net, but the bird's watching, or the bird knows better than going to the net.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, birds, I think there's also a little insult here. Look, even a bird knows not to walk into a net. And they're unreasoning creatures, right? They're instinctive, so. So I think there's a, don't be dumber than a bird. Maybe that's just the way I think, and that's why I saw it. That's possible, too. But that's also an effective way of teaching your children. You don't be dumb as a bird. Yeah.
Magicians and so on, but they all, I think most of their tricks often work by getting you to watch this.
Right.
You can't not watch it because it's a spectacular. I'm doing something over here. Meanwhile, I'm doing something over here that you're not watching.
Right.
Or in sports, watch me go this way with my head, but I'm actually going that way with my body. Or boxing, probably did that right. Let me fake you this way and go that way.
Yep.
Watch this thing because I'm going to, you know, you watch here and I'm going to stab you there.
Right.
You see it coming. So the same thing here to be. Don't watch the bait.
Don't watch the bait.
Spread there. And he was wise and able to say, I'm not watching your hand that you're razzled at. I'm going to watch what's really done here.
Out of curiosity, who today would say the things in verses 11, 12, 13, 14? Who might say that? Is this something that just happened in Solomon's day? I think not, actually. I think it's possible, but I think it depends on the geography. I think it depends on where you're at. But I was really struck in thinking through how familiar this picture is for gang membership.
Yeah. Okay. That was the first thing I thought of when I read.
Yeah. You know, now we don't want to set the bar so low that all we hope for is that our children would not belong to gangs, right? I mean, that's hardly a high bar. But if you're living in an inner city where there's a lot of threats, well, that bar suddenly looks very, very formidable, doesn't it? And these words come to life in very real ways. You know, we have our own gang problems here in this country. We have a lot of countries have gang problems. This is serious stuff. Liz? Sure.
Find this easy way.
Yep. Stephanie.
Well, I think it can be as simple as just the friends that you meet, you know. Come hang out with us. We're going, you know, I mean, we're just going to a party, we're drinking, we're doing drugs or whatever. Maybe it may not be the full extent of a gang, but a group of people who just want to be Jewish and rebel.
Right. Yeah.
I was also thinking, as you were talking, describing the sinners that are enticing, reminds me a lot of other parts of Scripture describing Satan.
That's right.
Lurking.
Sure.
Eating,
he's behind it, isn't he? Yeah, that's right. That's right.
There might also be something in this, just the general passivity of someone, even if you're just, you know, not putting yourself to good use. You can be set upon, by the essentially the devil, and just being taken over by lack of anything else to do, and just, you know, resorting to anything else you might want to do, you know.
The antidote is not passivity, is it? I just won't do that. No, do not consent. Do not walk in 15. Do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from the path. It's very active. Very active, you're right. You will slide this direction if you don't put forth some effort to avoid it. Good. All right, well, let's close in prayer.